This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Many things have changed since Vermont Gas Systems first submitted its application to the Public Service Board for approval to build out a natural gas pipeline, linking homes and businesses in Addison County to the fuel source. Later phases, which have not yet been approved by the PSB, would carry natural gas to Rutland County and across Lake Champlain to International Paper in Ticonderoga, New York. The Public Service Board approved Phase 1 over a year ago, but since then, Vermont Gas has twice revised the budget. The original estimate of $86.6 million has grown to $153.6 million, nearly doubling. Vermont's Public Service Department has asked the Public Service Board to take another look at the project and reconsider the Certificate of Public Good that gave the company the go-ahead on Phase 1. The company has also continued to face opposition from property owners in Addison County, and the project has sparked several public protests. And Vermont Gas also had a change of leadership, with CEO and President Don Gilbert retiring at the end of 2014 after 13 years in charge. Today, we'll get an update on where the pipeline stands and an explanation for the sharp rise in costs from the new CEO, Don Rendell, who's been introducing himself to the state lately. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, James. It's a pleasure to be here.
We'll also hear today from one of the opponents of the pipeline and why some property owners have resisted its construction. Joining us is Maren Vasatka, a Moncton property owner who lives in the proposed path of the pipeline. Maren, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Jane.
So let's start with a couple of questions about those cost projections, where they are, why they've risen so much, and then I want to bring Maren into the conversation and we can talk a little bit about the opposition. So Don Rendell, the original estimation for Phase 1 from Chittenden County through Addison County to the Middlebury area was $86.6 million. As I said, that estimate now, the third, is $153.6 million. That's an increase of over 80%. So why were you so far off?
Well, Jane, what we've done is a full ground-up re-estimate of the project. And what I can tell you is, as we move forward today, as we look forward, the estimated cost of the project is $154 million. Yeah, a big increase over the past. I'm not here to defend the past. I'm here to understand how we get to the finish line from here.
What were the areas where the cost increased the most?
Well, Jane, a whole variety of areas have increased. The cost of construction has increased. The cost of project management has increased. The cost of materials has increased. It's across the board.
Sure, but all of those are to be expected. When you delay a construction project, there certainly are increases the longer you go up, because generally those prices creep up the longer you wait, but not by 80%. I mean, that not even a conservative estimate would suggest that.
I'm not suggesting that it was because of inflation. I'm suggesting that the original estimate was inadequate as we sit here today, and what we're trying to do is to be sure that we have a solid estimate going forward.
I totally understand what you're saying there, and you want to move forward with this estimate. This is the estimate that's on the table now. This is what you expect the pipeline to cost, the Phase 1. But you got approval from the PSB based on that first estimate. So while you may not want to defend it, you certainly now have to defend this cost estimate and whether it is still in the public good and whether or not the PSB should just revoke that certificate and start over.
Well, Jane, I completely agree with you. It's really important that we do exactly what you described, which is we put that new estimate in front of the Public Service Department and the Public Service Board, and they have an opportunity to take a good hard look at it, just as we have. That's the work ahead.
We got a question from one of our listeners wondering if these new additional costs are going to be passed along to ratepayers in the price that they're paying for natural gas should this project be built.
Jane, what ratepayers have to pay for rates will be decided by the Public Service Board when it's time for us to go in for rates. What I can tell you is that the cost of this pipeline, along with the cost of all the entire infrastructure of Vermont Gas, all rolls into an overall cost of service. Our job is to make sure that our prices are competitive, are affordable, and we go through a very rigorous regulatory process before those prices are put into place.
But the bottom line is they will be rolled in because it will be a cost to the company. So that will be part of the rate that people are paying.
It will be part of the rate in one respect or another, understanding that our job is to make sure that those rates continue to be competitive and affordable.
So does that change how much you said, your company said, that ratepayers would save by building this project if their rates are now presumably higher because of the projected construction costs?
Jane, there's no doubt that the cost of the pipeline at $154 million eats into the benefit equation that was presented when this project was first proposed. That said, we've made a very careful estimate of the benefits going forward, and we're confident that we still have significant benefits for customers, for Vermont, for the environment, and that makes this still a good deal for Vermont.
Are you putting a number on that anymore?
A number on the benefits? Oh yes, we've got benefits of more than $200 million when you tally up all of the benefits around the horn.
Which is what you were saying before, right? It was over $200 million before the.
Yes. There's over the life of this project, there are still very significant greenhouse gas reductions. There are very significant reductions in fuel bills to new customers who choose natural gas. There are significant construction-related benefits, tax benefits, a whole host of benefits.
We're talking today about the natural gas pipeline that has been proposed to be built through Addison County, eventually over to International Paper in Ticonderoga, New York, and down into Rutland County. We're talking with Don Rendell, who's the new CEO of Vermont Gas. And if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions or comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Also with us today is Maren Vasatka. She's a Moncton property owner. She opposes the pipeline, which would go through her land. Maren, I understand that you actually grew up with natural gas in Minnesota, so the fuel source itself wasn't something that you've grown up being opposed to. So did your concern about this project start when you realized it would cross your property in Moncton?
No, my concerns about this project started when Vermont Gas couldn't answer any of our questions when they were seeking an easement across our property. That forced us to have to do our own research, and that's where we became educated about natural gas, fossil fuels, alternatives, and that's where we ended up today. The project itself does not make sense to us. The price increases are huge, and you just discussed those. While Mr. Rendell would like to say that the PSB decides the rates, Vermont Gas requests those rates from the PSB. So what are you going to request, Mr. Rendell? Not just what is the PSB going to approve? And honestly, you don't build trust by misrepresenting the truth. You treat people with respect and do it right. And you can stop the project, try to get it right, and if you do, you can come back and refile. That would show that you're building trust. You fired the engineering firm that created the budget, the $86 million budget, yet you want us to be comfortable with their engineering design that's going to be in our backyards as a homeowner? I'm not real comfortable with that. So those are additional concerns that aren't even being discussed. But if they terminated this firm because they couldn't come up with the numbers right, am I supposed to be comfortable with their engineering through and under the wetlands on my property and through the ledge that is 320 feet from my bedroom window?
Well, let's go through some of this. And here's what I'm hoping for the program is that we can have a discussion. Maren, I'd love for you to be able to sort of detail your opposition and a lot of the people that you're in contact with in Moncton and throughout Addison County about why you oppose the project. And we're going to respond. Let Don Rendell respond to your concerns and to some of the emails and comments we're getting from listeners. And I hope we can get a better sense of the project and where the rub is and why it's so controversial. I'm not assuming that you two will be in agreement on how to move forward or what the forward motion is after this, but I do hope that we have a better understanding of it. So let's talk first about the property owner's concerns over easements and why that process has been so contentious and has been, some property owners have said it's been kind of an insulting process. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then Don Rendell, I'd love for your response.
Well, they started out by trespassing on people's property without authority. They did surveys on property without right of entry agreement signed. We just found out now that they did that to our property back in 2012, only because we asked for our survey results, because we've never allowed them on our property to survey. So they started out by trespassing. Their right-of-way agents represented themselves to us as mediators, not as right-of-way agents working for Vermont Gas. They never disclosed who they were representing. They just came about looking for easements. So there was a lot of mistrust there. They started out with a project in Moncton that was going right down the road, right underneath people's bedroom windows. And it wasn't until the town got together and put a big uproar that they actually moved the pipeline to the back. So that was something that never crossed their minds. They never took responsibility for their subcontractors. When they trespassed, they said it was the subcontractors. When they couldn't answer questions, they said it was the subcontractors. Everything was always somebody else. So not taking responsibility for their subcontractors was a big concern to us. And those subcontractors are the ones that are designing the project. That's a big safety concern to us.
Okay, so Don Rendell, what about that? You've come on board recently, but you now have to answer for everything that's come before. And one of the things that you've said as CEO is you want to have better relationships with the landowners who are affected by this and more open and transparent communication. So Maureen Vasetka is saying from the very start, this was a sour relationship. What do you respond to her concerns?
No doubt for some landowners, from the very start, this was a very sour relationship. And that's in the past. I'm not making excuses for it. I'm here to say that going forward, our team is determined to be respectful of landowners, to listen to landowners, to do the right thing by landowners, to work really hard to come to collaborative agreements with landowners. This is a certificate of public good that the project is in the public interest. We, as Vermonters, we live in communities. We benefit from many community-based solutions for whether it's energy or transportation or telecommunications. And our job is to be confident that our landowners are listened to, that our landowners are respectfully dealt with, and that our landowners have the opportunity to have a good dialogue with us about their concerns, and we try to reach agreements.
It's one thing for you to say, let's start over again. I know this was sour, but let's start afresh. But what if they say no, or some of them say no? I mean, they don't have to say, oh, you're right, it's all in the past.
Absolutely. It's our job to rebuild trust where there is not trust.
So how do you do that?
Well, let's start with understanding where we are, which is 85% of the landowners along the route have made agreements with us, and we're in active negotiations with most of the rest. We do have a number that are very upset with Vermont Gas, and our job is to try to rebuild a respectful relationship with those folks and to reach agreements where we can, where we can't, and there will be some, there have been some who have been very upfront with us in saying, we don't want to talk to you, we're not interested in an agreement. We have a process for resolving that. That's the eminent domain process, and that is it's the last resort option. It's the option that will ensure that landowners receive fair value for being part of this project, for being impacted by this project.
At what point do you pull that trigger and go to eminent domain?
We will go to eminent domain when we have satisfied ourselves that we have done everything we possibly can to reach agreement with those who are willing to talk to us, and where we have reached that place where landowners say to us, we're done, we don't want to talk to you anymore.
So for the ones that have already, have you started proceedings?
No, we have not. We have not started eminent domain proceedings, and we won't until we've done another clear-eyed look to say, is there a path to successful collaboration here or not?
Maureen Vasetka, we have a lot to go over, so I won't stay on this particular topic for too long. And I also won't ask you to speak for all landowners, because as Don Rendell said, some landowners are happy with this project and are happy to move forward and have negotiated easements, and that's the end of the process for them. But you say some landowners are doing this not necessarily because they support the pipeline project. What are people that you're talking to, what are they saying about this easement process now?
Protecting our properties in phase one is totally separate from opposition to the pipeline. It's a separate issue. We need to protect our properties, and these easements do not protect landowners at all. They totally benefit Vermont Gas. So while 85% of the people may have signed easements, these easements can very easily come back at them.
Why? What do you mean by that?
When they go to sell their property, when they have appraisals, if they can't sell their property for what it's worth now. A lot of these landowners did not do easement mortgage modifications, which are required if you have a mortgage on your property. Vermont Gas did not tell people those were required. There's, you know, these easements can be are written as such that they can do whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want, and in some cases have ingress and egress. These landowners do not know what a lot of this means. Landowners are not experts in this. No way in the beginning did Vermont Gas ever come to us and say, we want an easement on your property and you should have legal representation. So here's some money to go hire an attorney so that we can have a fair discussion. That never happened. I understand easements, and this easement is extremely difficult to come to the bottom of.
And you partly understand easements because you've worked in real estate.
Yes, for 10 years.
So, Don Rendell, just before we move on, what about that? I mean, would you renegotiate with all of your landowners? Would you pay for lawyers if some ask for legal help in trying to negotiate with you and make sure that their rights are protected?
Jane, I think it's really important for us to work with the landowners in a proactive way, and where landowners feel that they need to have some kind of second look at this, we'll work with landowners to make sure that happens. With respect to landowners that have signed up, you know, we have a lot of respect at Vermont Gas for property owners and for property owners' rights, and I really am determined to respect those rights. And that means letting property owners make their own decisions about what they want to do when they're talking to us.
But there is something about a big company coming and talking to you and you know, a landowner saying, okay, I think I'm doing the right thing, but how do I know? I mean, it's one thing to say we respect your right to get a lawyer or not get a lawyer, but it's another thing to say you should get a lawyer, but if you don't, it's up to you.
Well, fair enough, Jane. Think of this, though, in the context of what we're talking about. We've got hundreds of miles of natural gas pipeline in Vermont. We've got millions of miles in the United States. More than 60% of Americans are natural gas users, 170-plus million Americans. This is not a situation where we should be putting fear into people where it's not warranted. It's important. It's important that landowners be respected. I think we should think about this in the context of all of the infrastructure that we as Vermonters deal with every day.
We're talking today about the natural gas pipeline that's been pretty controversial. It's proposed to be built from Chittenden County down through Addison County over to International Paper in Ticonderoga, New York, and down into Rutland County for many homeowners and ratepayers there. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Are you a property owner who's dealt with Vermont Gas regarding an easement on your land, or maybe a homeowner hoping to be able to get natural gas in your home? If you have a question or a thought on this project, you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Over a year ago, the Public Service Board approved a pipeline that would connect homes and businesses in Addison and Rutland counties and International Paper in Ticonderoga, New York, to a natural gas supply through the Vermont gas systems. It's become a controversial subject that extends far beyond the reach of the pipeline itself. That approval from the Public Service Board was just for phase one of the project, which would connect Chittenden to Addison County down to about Middlebury. The company is still trying to negotiate with many landowners in Addison County who oppose the project and do not want the pipeline built on their land. Today, we are revisiting the issue with Maren Vasatka. She lives in Moncton. She's one of those affected landowners voicing opposition to the pipeline. We're also talking with the new CEO and president of the company, Don Rendell. And we'd like to hear your thoughts and questions. Does the project still make sense? Do you have concerns as a landowner, as a Vermonter? Are you hoping for natural gas and wondering about the holdups in this project? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And let's go to Mark, who's calling in from Williston. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, I have a question. I understand there's multiple phases, so three or four of them. And the first one went from 80 to 150, roughly speaking, in terms of cost. And the benefit is touted at being $200 million. I was curious how, right after saying $200 million, there was talk about carbon emissions. So I'd really like to understand more about the $200 million. Is that including some kind of cost of carbon emissions? Just what makes up the $200 million? And is that $200 million for all the phases or just this first phase?
Mark, thanks for the questions. Don Rendell?
Thanks for the question, Mark. The $200 million, $200 plus million, is for phase one of the project, which is the phase that will run the pipeline from Chittenden County to Middlebury. And that's comprised of about $50 million in construction benefits, about $175 million in energy savings over 20 years based on recent oil prices, about $27 million in greenhouse gas reductions.
Mark, does that answer your question?
It does, but just a quick follow-up, because there was a mention of oil prices, recent oil prices, so that obviously it's going to fluctuate, but at least today it seems very inexpensive oil these days of late.
Sure, and as we do in this process, in the regulatory process, Mark, we do, the estimate is a forward-looking estimate, and it is based on estimates that include oil prices at the December levels.
So the December levels, which were a little bit higher than they are now, but December of 2014, you're talking about?
Yes, and then a projection going forward.
How much are you actually changing the cost projections for phases two and three, given that the cost projections have gone up so much for phase one?
Jane, we're in the process of figuring out the costs on phase two, and we're wrapping that up. And as soon as we're done working through that with our business partner, International Paper, then we'll let folks know what those numbers look like.
Safe to assume they're higher?
They'll be higher, yes, no doubt.
International Paper was willing to foot most of the bill for that phase two pipeline from Middlebury to International Paper itself and going under Lake Champlain. Is that being renegotiated? Is International Paper balking at that now?
We have an agreement in place with International Paper. We're working with an International Paper so that we can both understand what the costs are, and we'll go from there.
That agreement, though, was assuming that you'd get PSB approval by March of 2015, which is in question now. Isn't that true?
The agreement had a number of milestones in it, and the agreement is based on a schedule, which is a little different than where we are today. Yes.
So it needs to be renegotiated at the very least.
We'll certainly have to revisit the schedule as well as the cost. Yes.
Maren Vasetka, we were talking before the break a little bit about some of the concerns that landowners have about how it's worked to protect their property values and their financial interests. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other concerns that landowners have. You mentioned that in some cases it's entirely separate. Opposition to the pipeline can be separated from how landowners feel about protecting their property. So let's talk about some of those other issues, and we'll talk with Don Rendell about them as well. The environmental impact of the project, you're concerned about that, specifically wetlands in Moncton.
Correct.
Talk about it.
To my knowledge, not all the surveying has been done. That's what Vermont Gas has. Now Vermont Gas is saying they've done the surveying, but they're drilling under a swamp, the Moncton Swamp, which is a pristine swamp. They're going through ledge. Most of Moncton is ledge or wetlands. And nothing, they haven't surveyed a lot of properties, so they don't know what they're dealing with there. So obviously these costs are going to increase. And where you start out with, in July, when you increase the costs to $121 million, at that time you were quoting the benefits at $152 million. And now we've jumped this other number, and somehow the benefits jumped to $200 million, now down to $174 million with the comparison of oil. The environmental impact on our area and the amount of money being spent on this project is of big concern to all of us that are being affected by it, because it seems like a lot of money being spent in an area that is building a fossil fuel infrastructure that we're going to continue to rely on. Addison County is really big on alternative energy sources. Moncton is looking at building a solar farm that their residents can tie into. Other communities have that. A lot of people are doing solar panels. We have the area, the land. We're rural enough. We can look at alternatives. We're a great poster child for an alternative energy community. We don't want another fossil fuel that people are going to rely on instead of move to something that's more beneficial for the environment.
Let me bring in two listener comments that we got that are on similar concerns and similar questions. And then, Don Rendell, I'll let you jump in. Steve posted saying, we need to move away from fossil fuel, not add more. Natural gas is not a bridge fuel. When you add in all the methane lost in the drilling, transmission, and inadequate sealing of wellheads, it adds up to more greenhouse gas pollution than just calculating what happens at the burning point. On the other hand, Andrew's in favor of the pipeline. He says Vermont will be using lots of fossil fuels for years to come. We drive everywhere, we eat foods grown with tractors and delivered by trucks, and we heat our homes with oil. If we could be using a cleaner fossil fuel, natural gas, we should. All right, so three different perspectives there, but all talking, sort of wrapping around this concept of the environmental impact. Don Rendell.
Let's talk about the environmental impact of natural gas service first, Jane. The purpose of this infrastructure project is to give Vermont families and businesses another important energy choice. We're confident that Vermonters will make smart decisions about their energy choices, and I am very confident in a sustainable energy future for Vermont for some of the reasons that Marin described. That is that we have a very bright future with renewable energy, and we're making great advances. Natural gas can be part of that, as we can find ways with natural gas in the here and now to reduce carbon and to provide an energy source that's much more affordable for Vermont families and businesses. There is no doubt that we have a lot of work to do as a country around responsible regulation of oil and gas production, both oil and gas production, and will be a voice that advocates for that kind of responsible and effective regulation and enforcement of oil and gas production.
Even if it puts you out of business?
I'm confident that it won't put us out of business. I'm confident that we'll get to a place, as we have with the Clean Water Act, as we have with the Clean Air Act, in making great progress in advancing environmental enforcement, in reducing environmental impacts, and still be able to provide our families and businesses with the important products, with the important services, with the important energy sources that they deserve.
Maren, do you see other sources of energy or other, you know, you talked about the solar farm being built in Moncton, and Moncton is sort of one community that we're using here as an example because that's where you live and it is on the pipeline path, but I want to acknowledge there are certainly other communities mm-hmm. involved in this. But do you see other ways of getting energy to people's homes that will compete with oil and with natural gas to make natural gas a less appealing proposition? I know you're not an energy expert, but you've looked into these.
I'm not an energy expert, but there is alternative. There's biomass, and there's also cold weather heat pumps are becoming popular. You can run them off solar. But I think I want to make a comment to what Mr. Rendell said about giving people all these options and that's how we're going to lower. Franklin and Chittenden County still has not hooked up all their residents. You have a lot of people in Franklin mm-hmm. County that want natural gas, but you want to charge them $30,000 to hook up their house. So why not? They're the ones contributing to this money. They're the ones that are paying $4.4 million a year for 20 years in their rates. So why not take that money and help them help their neighbors get that quote-unquote greener fuel? Why come into a county that has better choices right now if you want to help
well, but
the
hang on. So let me jump in here before we ask Don Rendell that question. Why would any company that has an interest in a certain type of fuel try to then give money to something else? I mean, it is a business that he's running. So why would you expect him to do that?
He's using ratepayers' money. He's using ratepayers from Franklin and Chittenden County. So help hook up more people in Franklin and Chittenden County.
I see. So you mean use that money to help the neighbors where the pipeline has already been
right,
built out,
correct.
not help people in Addison County get heat pumps.
If he thinks that's that people need to be on it,
got it
to overall help our overall greenhouse gases, put the people who are already on the pipeline up in Franklin County on the pipeline.
Okay, got it. I see what you're asking. Don Rendell?
We're doing both. The Vermont Gas started in 1966 with about 6,000 customers. We're now up to almost 50,000 customers over 50 years. We've filled out tremendously in Franklin and Chittenden counties, and we continue to do that, and we're aimed at that. In addition to bringing the opportunity to have natural gas service to families and businesses in Addison County and ultimately to Rutland County. You know, I hear from people every day who are asking, how can we get natural gas service? We want the price reductions. We want the affordability. We want the environmental benefits. And that's what we're aiming to do in a responsible way.
We got a question from Ivor in Moncton who says, Vermont Gas first requested funding for this project at a cost of $59 to $69 million to extend gas service from the existing gas terminus in Shelburne to Vergennes and on to Middlebury. This is a fairly straightforward pipeline extension down the Route 7 or the Velco rail line right-of-way. Why doesn't VGS return to its original proposal to run gas straight down the much shorter Route 7 corridor at a significantly lower cost to taxpayers, ratepayers, excuse me?
Well, Jane, the great question. The project has been engineered and presented fully to the Public Service Board. A lot of time, effort has been spent to
and money to
create a route, to look at the environmental impacts, to work with the environmental regulators as well as the utility regulators, to ensure that we have the right route for this pipeline, and this is the one that the Public Service Board has looked at. This is the one that we presented. This is the one that the Public Service Board has looked at. This is the one that many environmental experts have looked at, and this one works.
Maren Vasek, I want to bring you in here because I know you wanted to address that question of engineering. You had spoken right at the beginning about the firm that had done the original cost estimates and the design and planning, and you're concerned that there's now a new firm, but still some of the old plans. What's your concern there?
Well, he didn't, when that question was addressed to him before the break, he didn't answer the question of safety. The firm that did the engineer design is the firm that was terminated. So there's never been anything about looking into their engineering design.
Okay, so how about that? That's a concern for at least one Moncton landowner that you've changed contracts. You're now going with PricewaterhouseCoopers, right, for the cost estimate. What about that engineering and design plan that should ensure and reassure landowners that it is safe, given that you've terminated that contract?
Well, that's a great contrast here. That engineering and design plan presented, reviewed, a lot of environmental Vermont-centric, Vermont-based environmental experts looking at that plan, presented to the Public Service Board, vetted by the regulatory process. It's a good plan. There's not a question about that. We have a good plan. We have a certificate of public good based on that plan. The question is, how much is it going to cost to build it? And that's the question that we're dealing with in the here and now. With respect to safety, safety is really important, and it's front and center every day at Vermont Gas Systems. We've got one of the tightest, best performing distribution gas systems in America at Vermont Gas. It's modern, it's tight, it's safe, and we will continue to have that as we move forward in time. We've got a really strong record on safety, and I think it's important for Vermont Gas to be judged on its record of safety.
Barring a wholesale redesign of this project, which would be a lot of money and a lot more time, Maren, what would convince you?
I think the same investigation should go into the engineering design that's going into the cost estimate.
Same investigation by whom?
By the Public Service Department and the Public Service Board. I mean, the department even admitted in some interviews that they relied on Vermont Gas as the experts to give them this information. So that CPG that was issued on $86 million is issued on a design created by that same deficiency. I think it needs to be looked into.
So would you like the Public Service Board to pull the certificate and reevaluate the entire project? They are looking at this again, but it's sort of the extent of the look is a little bit unclear at this point.
I go back to my original statement. If they want to gain trust, this project has been through too many. Already we're at the table with the third cost estimate and third review by the Public Service Board. I think the whole project needs to stop. If you can get it right, come back and refile it.
Is there any way they could get it right with you?
If they refile it, if they put together a proper cost estimate with an engineering design, surveys, and work with landowners instead of against landowners.
But that's a yes. There is a way that they could come back to you and you would say, I support this project?
I don't know. I haven't been faced with that option. I haven't had that decision to make yet.
Don Rendell, what's the next step for you?
Next step for us is to make the presentation to the Public Service Board on the cost estimate. Next step is to have the Public Service Department, the other parties to that proceeding, provide their input to have a vigorous, rigorous, disciplined discussion about where we are and where we're going, and to proceed from there.
Don Rendell is the new CEO of Vermont Gas Systems. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you.
And Maren Vasatka is a Moncton property owner. She opposes the pipeline. Thank you for showing your opposition and talking with us on the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Coming up, lawmakers are working on a plan to close the $100 million budget shortfall in the state. We'll get an explainer on the billions of dollars that flow into and out of state coffers. That's just ahead on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We've been hearing for months that the state budget has a projected shortfall of around $100 million, which means if nothing is done, that would be the state's deficit at the end of the fiscal year in July. To close that budget gap, lawmakers and officials in the governor's administration will look at an array of levers to pull, ways to increase revenue through taxes and fees, and places to cut spending and state services. But what does a $100 million gap look like against state spending that reaches into the billions? VPR State House reporter Pete Hirschfeld joins me now for a budget explainer. Hi, Pete.
Hey, Jane.
How big is the state budget?
Well, it's quite big. As it turns out, the all-in number, and get ready here because I'm going to give you a lot of digits, is $5,661,825,290.
Woo.
They actually break it down like that to the dollar. Now, that's actually the proposal for the fiscal year 2016 budget that hasn't been passed yet, but the governor laid out a proposal for a couple weeks ago. It really is a difficult number to wrap your brain around, but it's a number that reminds you just how significant a role government plays in the lives of the people that created it. And that $5.6 billion figure translates into $9,041 for every man, woman, and child in the state of Vermont.
Wow. And that number, that $5.6 billion, some of that is state-raised revenue, some of it is federal spending?
Yeah, you know, very broadly speaking, there's state money and there's federal money, and the split is about $3-plus billion on the state side and about $2 billion on the federal side.
When we talk about the state budget, it's not really one big budget, one big bucket of money that's being pulled from. It's sort of a handful of buckets and different funds, as they call them often. So can you explain how it's structured broadly?
The state segregates its money into three funds. There's the general fund, the education fund, and the transportation fund. Now, the general fund is the biggest of the three. It's about $1.4 billion this year, and it's spent on what's generally known as general government. The biggest cost driver here, of course, is at the Agency of Human Services, where we have all these programs to help people who qualify for state and federal assistance. The education fund is right behind, a little over $1.2 billion. This, of course, is the money that goes to fund public schools and the teachers and staff that work at them. And finally, we have the transportation fund with close to $300 million. And this is all the money we use to keep our roads paved, our bridges strong, our culverts clear. And then the $2 billion in federal money finds its ways into each of those funds depending on what it's been earmarked for.
Can you go a little deeper in explaining how certain revenue sources are tied to specific expenses? I mean, just thinking of a couple, the education property tax that goes into the ed fund, fishing licenses are tied to certain buckets. So how does that get broken down when we think about the ways that revenue is raised?
Yeah, theoretically, there is a method to this bureaucratic madness, and each fund is supposed to be supported by revenues that you might think make sense to support that specific public purpose. The money for the education fund, as you noted, comes primarily from the property tax. The general fund comes mostly from revenue generated from taxes on personal income, sales and use, and rooms and meals. Transportation dollars come from taxes on gasoline and diesel and motor vehicle fees, like when you send in a check for your new registration or license.
Is there borrowing from the fund? Sometimes we hear about, you know, so and such and such has pilfered from such and such fund.
Yeah, to the unending frustration of many lawmakers, there is a lot of sharing that goes on between funds. The biggest one is what's known as the general fund transfer, and this refers to the approximately $300 million in general fund money that will be sent over to support the education fund. This happens on an annual basis. Over in the transportation fund, meanwhile, they send about $20 million a year to the general fund to support the state police. And it's a practice that has a lot of legitimate reasons for being there, but it has also created opportunities to solve shortfalls in one line item with funds from somewhere else. And while you can resolve immediate budget pressures pretty easily by increasing or decreasing these transfers, it also serves to siphon money away from the things that that money was originally supposed to support.
Pete, I mentioned that budget gap that we're looking at and talking about all the time right now. Looks at about $100 million right now, although, you know, it can shift a little bit. How does a gap like that develop in an economy that's fairly steady?
So you ask a great question. We're several years into our post-recession recovery. How is it that we keep finding ourselves with these big budget gaps? And the answer is that increases in revenues are not keeping pace with increases in the cost of government. And that's because key economic variables just aren't coming back as quickly as they have historically. The best example is personal income. The S&P might be doing great right now, middle class incomes or not. And because so much of our revenue base relies on the personal income tax, we're not seeing that increase at the rate we would need to support the cost drivers in state government. Healthcare costs, union salaries, all these things that are going up faster than personal income is. And so, you know, when it comes time to reconcile the budget, there's this major shortfall.
Well, and we're certainly going to be looking at that over the coming weeks as the legislature and the administration try to figure out how to close that gap. Incidentally, no requirement in the state constitution to actually balance the budget, but it is something that there's a lot of pressure to do. So Peter Hirschfeld, our State House reporter, will keep us up to date on what's happening in the halls of the State House. Pete, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jane.
Vermont Edition's managing producer Patty Daniels joins me in the studio now to share some of the messages we've received about recent programs. Hey, Patty.
Hi, Jane. So we've got comments on two topics today, and we're going to start with pot. Last week, we looked at some of the issues involved in legalizing marijuana in Vermont, and here is just a sampling of the comments.
On the pro side, Adam says that legalizing marijuana creates, quote, more much-needed tax revenue, and it means less spending on policing a safe plant. And Don says, the first issue is setting this up so farmers and small local businesses can succeed and share the benefits through sensible taxing and regulation. Patty, jump in. You want to go to the anti side.
Okay, so let's go to the con side. A listener posting as concerned Vermonter says, legalizing this drug is a huge mistake. Legalized mass marketing will result in more kids using the drug, as we saw with alcohol and tobacco. The powerful tobacco and alcohol lobbies have worked our state house, and they've prevented an increase in the taxes needed to pay for their costs to society. And they were successful. Big marijuana will be the same.
And KWF says, my opinion is that we need to have an addiction problem. We do have one, KWF says, with alcohol, opiates, weed, etc. Resources would be better spent getting to the bottom of addictive behavior. The legal wing should be punishing illegal behavior that may or may not be associated with drugs rather than owning the drugs.
Okay, so you can listen to that show and join the online discussion, read other listeners' thoughts. All of it is online still at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Next up, listener comments on our recent interview with the Imam of the Vermont Islamic Society, Islam Hassan. He has been speaking to his worshipers at the mosque about recent terrorist attacks by religious fundamentalists, attacks which he condemns.
Mark posted this comment. I fully believe in freedom of speech for all. Differences of opinion are welcome and should be debated. I just don't believe that public humiliation and ridicule are freedom of speech. It's provocation. It will not pave the road to a more understanding world. Killing isn't the answer either.
And Dara and Warren writes, now is the time for greater tolerance of all faiths and traditions, not mean-spirited, provocative images and speech. We, the colonial powers of old, need to look deeply at how our exploitation of the peoples on all continents have perhaps sown the seeds of anger and hatred being acted out against us now.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Farzin says, I'm a person who worships with Muslims and with Quakers. I so love the tenderness and simplicity with which this interview was undertaken. Thank you for showing us a way of communicating and being together as a community, allowing space for questions, allowing space for responses. It feels like peace.
Well, we always welcome comments and feedback on the program. You can reach out to us in a lot of different ways. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Vermont Edition, and we post online discussions for Everyday Show at vpr.net.
However you choose to contact us, we hope to hear your feedback about the program. And Patty, thanks for sharing some of the comments with us.
You are welcome.
All right, that's it for today. Tomorrow, we will be live at the Farm Show at the Champlain Valley Exposition. Every winter, the Farm Show showcases new tractors and heavy equipment, and it's a chance for farmers to trade ideas and information about issues affecting them. Top on the list for our discussion tomorrow, the role of farms in degrading the water quality of Lake Champlain. We'll take up the controversial subject with the head of the Agency of Agriculture and with the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, again, live at the Farm Show tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Rick Singeri, with production assistance from Devin Karambalis. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.